I didn't explain to you you were gone. I did tell your attorney that I'm not a police officer, but I am conducting this interview at the request of detectives. So, as far as this form is concerned and the interview portion of it, it's just as if a police officer or a detective were talking to you or conducting the interview, so I want you to know that.
Late on the night of March 26, 1990, police pulled in a person of interest for questioning about the murder of Elizabeth McIntosh. They had learned that Michael, Elizabeth's supervisor on the Covenant Seminary house cleaning staff, had some run-ins with her, and they thought he had made some suspicious statements to officers earlier that day. But after several different detectives questioned Michael at the police station, they let him go. The next day, Michael lawyered up, and on the advice of his new lawyer, he declined to take a polygraph test.
But less than a month later, Michael changed his mind. Against the advice of his attorney, he sat for a polygraph examination that lasted almost 3 hours. And the audio recording of that examination gives us a glimpse into how the pressures of this case and the police investigation weighed on Michael. What changed his mind? What did he talk about? And what were the consequences for the unsolved murder of Elizabeth McIntosh?
This is True Believer, Episode 8. The polygraph. As you just heard in the intro, and as we talked about in episode 3, the day after the murder, Michael retained an attorney who more or less advised him not to talk to anyone about anything at any time. And this is very basic legal advice. You'd get it from almost every attorney on almost every issue. The attorney's name was Norm Stimel, and he eventually went on to be a Missouri Circuit Court judge. What's interesting about Stimel is that he was a good friend of Mark Bell's, who was Covenant's attorney at the time. In episode 4, we talked about Mark Bell's handling Covenant's internal investigation after the murder, which we'll talk a lot more about in the next episode. According to Mark Bell's, Norm Stimel was recommended to Michael by Covenant President Paul Koistra. So, March 27th, Michael declines the police request to take a polygraph test, on the advice of his new attorney, Norm Stimel. On March 30th, Stimel sent a letter to the Creve Corps police, requesting an itemized list of what was taken from Michael's home during their search at about 9:30 p.m. on the day of the murder. According to the police report, Michael's wife Jill is the one who signed the voluntary consent to search form, which gave the police permission to search their apartment and also their car. I'm speculating here, but I'm assuming this was a strategic move by the police because at that moment, Michael was still at the police station being questioned. The police had picked Michael up and brought him to the station earlier that evening. Jill had also been questioned by the police at the station that evening, but she was home by this point. Presumably, the police thought they'd have a better chance of getting Jill to sign the form when she was alone. Also, at this point, they had yet to retain an attorney. Anyway, the police report lists the items that they took, including Michael's work shoes, a pair of scissors from the kitchen, Michael's carry bag, a serrated knife which was in the bag, and one of Michael's notebooks. It's worth mentioning that, according to Michael's attorney, months later the items still hadn't been returned to him. On April 3rd, Michael was subpoenaed by the grand jury of St. Louis County to produce hair samples, which he gave the next day. Two Creve Corps detectives picked him up and drove him to the station to take the sample, one of whom was Dennis Sporey, whom you heard from earlier in this series. The other officer, Sergeant David Ventimiglia, had a contentious interaction with Michael at the police station. Here I'll quote from the Major Case Squad report. Quote, "While en route, Michael appeared calm and talkative. At the station, while waiting for an ID detective, Michael was talking about the case. Sergeant Ventimiglia asked Michael what God is going to do to the perpetrator of the offense. Michael became nervous and upset at this question and requested that Ventimiglia leave the room. When Ventimiglia refused to leave, Michael became visibly angry. Ventimiglia then stated to Michael, 'You seem to have a temper,' at which time Michael changed his expression and stated in a calm voice that he didn't want to talk." Unquote. After this interaction, Michael's hair sample was taken, along with a fingernail scraping. They also took his fingerprints. The police report notes that Michael's attorney was present for this proceeding, although it's not clear whether or not the attorney was there when Michael had the exchange with Sergeant Ventimiglia. It's also worth saying that during his first interview on the night of March 26, Michael voluntarily submitted to a physical examination by the police, who searched him for bruises or signs of a physical altercation. And no such bruises or signs were found. Now, around this time and over the next couple weeks, Michael began wavering over whether or not he should sit for the polygraph interview, despite his attorney's advice against it. Here's a clip from that eventual interview where Michael describes his dilemma. And one quick thing before we start playing these polygraph clips. We've cleaned up the audio as best we can, but it can still be a little hard to understand in some places. So we've compiled a PDF transcript of all the clips, which you can find a link to in the show notes.
The main thing that changed my mind was I talked to the president a couple of times. He said something like I should take it on that, but he likes the police to get out like that. You know, it's kind of like his thing. He thinks that. Well, what he and Steinle told me was that if the cases are closed, that, and if I was still a suspect, that the police would just kind of like keep coming at me. You know, 6 months later, a year later, that type of thing. They'd talk to, if I got a job in a church, they'd come and talk to the senior pastor about it. They'd come and talk to other people about it. And that it would just continue. And I didn't want to take the polygraph test with the idea that if they didn't have evidence against me, they couldn't arrest me. If they arrested me, it'd probably ruin me as far as my career is concerned. So I just wanted to protect them that way. The other reason I decided to take it was it would ruin me if I didn't take it if people could run around constantly asking questions about me about the ministry. Hopefully it would take some heat off of me.
So essentially, Michael wanted to clear his name, both with the police and with people in the Covenant community. He thought that by taking the polygraph, the police would leave him alone, and everyone would see that he had nothing to hide. And people at Covenant, including President Koistra, had told him it would be good if he cooperated. On April 20th, the date the polygraph examination eventually took place, Norm Steimel wrote a letter to Michael, outlining his reasons for advising Michael not to take the polygraph. But it also lists Michael's reasons for wanting to take it, including the police continuing to hound him, how it might look to churches he'd eventually want to work at, and how the pressure of being the main suspect was affecting his studies and his marriage. The letter concludes with this, quote, "For these reasons, it is now your desire to submit to the polygraph examination, in the hope that, upon passing, you'll no longer be considered a suspect in the case, and that you'll be able to return to a relatively normal life. We've discussed the risk to you inherent in your submitting to the polygraph examination, and yet you wish to proceed. By signing the signature line at the bottom of this letter, you are acknowledging that the decision to take the polygraph examination is yours and yours alone, and that it is against my advice." Unquote. Michael signed and sat for a 3-hour interview with Sam Yarborough, an outside polygraph examiner who sometimes worked with the Creve Coeur Police Department. Now, a lot of that interview covers the same ground as Michael's first interview on March 26th, the day of the murder. Given the length of the recording, there's far too much for us to try to cover in this episode, but we are going to try to hit some of the highlights. One thing to keep in mind, though, earlier in Steimel's letter to Michael, as part of the reasons why he should not take the polygraph, Steimel says this, quote, "Although we've been led to believe by the police that if you pass the test, you will no longer be considered a suspect, that is simply not true. Obviously, if you pass the test, the police may have less reasons to suspect that you are not telling the truth. But it's equally possible that they will conclude that you have somehow managed to beat the test and that they will continue looking at you." Unquote. This advice turned out to be eerily prescient. But before we get into the audio from Michael's polygraph, I want you to hear from Ryan Davidson, a lawyer who reached out to Ruth and me with some thoughts about the legal aspects of this case. Ryan got his bachelor's degree from Covenant College, which is the undergrad sister school of Covenant Seminary, and his law degree is from Notre Dame. Here, Ryan talks about the broad brush legal advice to not talk to the police.
So, by way of background, I have a law degree, practiced law for more than a dozen years, doing something else right now because my solo practice didn't survive COVID, but criminal defense background, I've done this. And yeah, any criminal defense attorney will tell you, almost no matter what your circumstances, there is no upside to talking to the police. It can only make things worse for you. And it sounds like Michael received exactly that advice from his attorney. And he did anyway, And I think we're seeing the consequences of that. But so why is this advice given? Well, let's sort of go through some of the situations that a person could find themselves in. You know, maybe you did it. Okay, well, in that case, talking to the police is clearly a bad idea. Okay, and then in sort of ascending order of plausibility, it could be that the police are maliciously out to get you. This is a thing that happens. The idea of police discrimination is live, right? This is something that people are aware of. It might not even be that, though. Maybe you didn't do it, but the police sincerely think that you did. Okay, talk to them then, and they're looking to find a way of putting this on you. They think you did it. They are going to interpret everything you say in that direction. They are looking to charge someone. You could find yourself talking about things and saying things that maybe you don't even understand are incriminating. Because remember, the police don't have to tell you everything they know, and they are allowed to lie to you, and they do all the time. And let's talk about the idea of what an incriminating statement is. Again, the standard line that we hear in police procedurals all the time is, you know, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. Well, two things about that. First, it's true. Anything you say can be used against you. And as a matter of practicality, it's only going to be used against you. The police are not going to use anything you say to your advantage. They are trained, and this is even more true 30-odd years ago than it is now, to infer guilt at every possible opportunity. They are looking for things that they consider to be suspicious. And that's really all they need to keep you on the hook here. Look at them too much? That's suspicious. Don't look at them at all? That's suspicious. Fidget? That's suspicious. Sit perfectly still? That's suspicious. There's a whole non-falsifiable, any response at all way of thinking about human interactions that police are trained in. So anything and everything that you say is going to be construed in the worst possible light. Maybe it's directly making you look guilty to them. Maybe it's just that you have something to hide. And remember, you do. Everyone does. Everyone has things that we've done that we're not proud of. Everyone has situations that have occurred that are uncomfortable or were traumatic. Everyone has memories we prefer not to revisit. You know, maybe the reason you don't really want to talk about where you were when this happened is because you're having a fight with your wife. Or maybe you were cheating on her. Who knows? There could be any number of reasons, valid, legitimate, or really unsavory, that you might not want to talk about what the police are asking about. They're going to interpret that as you having something to hide about this particular subject.
Are there any different or additional risks of sitting for a polygraph exam?
Sort of, but at that point, some of those risks may be baked in. If we're thinking about the risk in terms of sitting down for a police interview or sitting down for a police polygraph, I mean, the polygraph is probably a worse situation for you, but only because the police think the polygraph is a good idea. It isn't that the polygraph gives the police an advantage. Some of them think that it does. They're wrong, but they're going to act like it does. And the odds of this working out well for you are even lower if they're using a polygraph. But a lot of the techniques and notions that go into the quote-unquote science of the polygraph, it is no such thing, animate a lot of police interrogation techniques. And they don't need a polygraph machine to employ some of those techniques on the fly. So, no, in a sense, a polygraph doesn't materially change things, but the mere fact that they're using one is not a good sign. So does the fact that he wanted to go in and talk to them say anything? I mean, it seems terrible to say it, but potentially naivete? You know, I want to go in and clear my name. That is the one thing that is not going to happen here. Your lawyer told you that. The police talk a good game. You know, come on in. We'll square this up. No, that's not what's going to happen. That is not what they're trying to do. Given his career prospects at this point for going into the ministry, it makes a certain kind of sense that he would grasp at any straw offered him in terms of wanting to clear this up. But I think his lawyer was right. Going and taking a polygraph is not going to make that happen. That is not the most likely outcome. And that gets a lot messier if someone at Covenant Seminary Administration suggested that his cooperation with the police was going to affect his eligibility for something like ordination. The, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, why not? It's like, yeah, that intuitively, that is a compelling thing to say. Practically speaking, that is not how that works. If you've got nothing to hide, keep your mouth shut.
In that last polygraph clip, you heard Michael talking about his reasons for wanting to take it, including conversations he had with President Paul Koistra. We'll talk more about some of Michael's interactions with Covenant administrators in the next episode. But here it's worth taking a few minutes to talk about what we can confirm about the polygraph interactions through documents we've reviewed. In the polygraph interview, Michael says that he had multiple conversations with President Koistra, and that Koistra wasn't certain whether or not Michael should take the polygraph, but that he wanted the police to get off Michael's back. In the audio recordings that we've reviewed, this is Michael's only mention of conversations with the president about the polygraph. Then, about 3 weeks later, Michael's lawyer, Norm Stimel, sent a letter to Covenant's lawyer, Mark Bells, discussing Michael's refusal to cooperate with Covenant's internal investigation. In that letter, Stimel writes this, quote, "Upon advice of counsel, Mike refused to submit to a polygraph examination. As you know, the polygraph is not deemed to be scientifically reliable, and we were very much concerned that there might be some attempt to manipulate the results of the test. At the urging of Dr. Koistra, Mike finally agreed to submit to a polygraph examination," unquote. So that paints a slightly different picture of the advice that Koistra gave Michael, urging rather than not being sure. In a letter dated March 2, 1991, so almost a year later, Michael writes this to President Koistra. Quote, "It does not seem right to us that you should initiate and maintain new sanctions against us in an effort to force us to submit to your investigation in the supposed hope of being cleared or exonerated when the police did not indict me despite an intensive investigation against me, an investigation which included a polygraph examination, which I took upon your advice, during which I gave more information," unquote. So again, the picture that Michael paints after the polygraph is different from the way he seemed to characterize it during the polygraph. But there is a section of the Major Case Squad report that seems to give credence to Michael's later characterizations. After a police interview with President Koistra and Vice President Chappell on April 27, 1990, the report says this, quote, "Dr. Koistra stated that prior to Michael taking the polygraph test, they had numerous conversations. Koistra told Michael that he could not recommend him for service anywhere unless he did everything he could to clear his name. Michael told Koistra that he wanted to take the polygraph. However, his attorney had advised him not to. Koistra stated that Michael called him later and stated that he knew he had to take the polygraph test and would cooperate with the police," unquote. Here's Ruth.
So it doesn't seem like Koistra was unduly influencing Michael to take the polygraph specifically. Maybe it feels like that in hindsight. But Koistra says he was genuinely being asked for advice and he gave his honest advice, and that's what ended up happening.
Even if in hindsight that advice looks to be very bad advice, at least based on what Ryan Davidson's told us.
It appears to be bad advice and against the advice of his lawyer. And so, you know, one of the questions we've had, and I can't really answer it because Paul Koistra has declined an interview with us, is really, like, were they giving the same advice to all students? Because there were other students that did decide to take the polygraph also. One student I remember had a lot of hesitations about whether he should do that, but ended up cooperating. And Michael also did also end up sitting for the polygraph.
Yeah, there's also a third student listed in the Major Case Squad report, so there's at least three Covenant students that we know of who took the polygraph. So, Ruth, one of the things that we've heard, and this actually came from one of Michael's family members, is this idea that Covenant coerced Michael into taking the polygraph. So, does this feel like coercion to you based on what Michael has said in his polygraph interview, and then based on the other documents that we've gone through?
I don't know what I think, really. I can't tell. It's just, it's so long ago, and maybe somebody involved in the situation at the time does feel like it was pressure or force in an unfair way. You know, especially there was some chatter between Michael and staff at the time, too, about, well, like, don't you want to get a job in the ministry? It would look bad if you stopped cooperating with police. Force seems like a strong word. It seems like a lot of people thought they were giving him good advice, and they weren't necessarily trying to say, hey, let's make sure Michael gets a murder charge. I mean, I am conflicted because I see where the family's coming from, too.
There's really two issues at play here. So one, we'll call the ethics of what kind of advice Covenant administrators were giving Michael. It goes against the advice of his attorney. In hindsight, looks like it was pretty bad advice. So that's the ethical side of it. But there's also potentially this legal side. And this law that was passed in 1988 called the Employee Polygraph Protection Act. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Okay, so this is my non-lawyer, very abbreviated version of a very obscure labor law. In 1988, there was a law passed, the EPPA. This says that a company cannot force one of its own employees to sit for a polygraph test. Think of that in a employment workforce context. And so a question has come up of, was it illegal for Michael to sit for that polygraph, especially if his employer, Covenant Seminary, was encouraging him, or all the way from encouraging to possibly forcing him to take it? I didn't know the answer to that question. We ran it by Ryan. He thinks it's a big stretch because even though the law was passed in 1988, it wouldn't have really been in effect for a while after that. And there's some added questions of whether a religious employer would have even been caught up in that until a few years later. And so you can kind of see, like, just barely by the calendar, March 1990, this possibly could have been considered illegal.
Yeah, there's no indication in any of the documents that we've looked at that Michael's lawyer was aware of this, or if he was, he never mentioned anything about it. So it seems like it wasn't on anyone's mind at the time. And the other thing about the law is that there's the text of a law that gets passed, but then it takes a while for this to work its way through the court system and for the legal system to kind of figure out what the law actually means. What will hold up in court? What kind of cases does this law cover? What kind of cases does it not cover? And so the thing was so new that it hadn't really had time to be processed through the system yet. So anyway, all of that is to say that it seems like it would have been a big stretch for this to have been held up in court if Michael had even brought a case based on this law.
Well, and so that's the other issue. He would have had to make the claim in order to see if it applied at all. He never made the claim. So it kind of gets back to this idea of, like, did Covenant act against the law? I don't think so on that one. And nobody claimed it. So it's really hard to make a case that nobody ever tried to argue. Obviously, you know, it's still a good moral question now, 34 years after the fact, of did Covenant act improperly? But just personally, this is not the thing that I would argue on.
So with all that background in mind, the polygraph interview starts off with basic questions about Michael's personal info, his family and education background, and so forth. Michael says he got a clinical psychology degree in 1977, but had been working mostly as a custodian at various universities since then. Here's Sam Yarborough.
Why would you have a medical psychology background and be employed in this particular area? Well, that's a good question. It's kind of a long story. I originally went to the seminary in at Trinity for the counseling program. I applied too late and I wasn't accepted, and while I was there, I was a full-time custodian there. And I just decided to study more theology and not really get involved in the program after some frustration trying to get into one. And then after that, I was interested in pursuing a Master's of History degree. That was why I was one of the reasons I went to Wheaton, but that didn't work out very well either. So it's been one thing after another, and finally I decided to go back to seminary for the MDiv. At Trinity, I would have been involved in the MDiv counseling, not MDiv more pastoral work, I think. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
So between 1977, when he graduated with his undergrad, and when he started at Covenant Seminary in 1986, Michael worked mostly as a custodian, with several unsuccessful attempts at other degree programs. We're highlighting this because it fits a certain pattern that's emerged as we've been working on this series. We've had dozens of people reach out to us with their stories, most of whom are connected to Covenant in some way. One thing that many of these people have independently told us is that Covenant Seminary in 1990 seemed to be a place that some men would go as a kind of last resort, although the standards seem to have gotten more rigorous and more strict in subsequent years. Here, I'll quote from one person we spoke with, although, again, many people have expressed similar sentiments to us. Quote, "These people often saw themselves as misunderstood and underappreciated. Many were hopeful for ministerial and pastoral positions at one of the established PCA churches in St. Louis, and if they didn't receive the position, were quite frustrated. Often these folks were at seminary because previous jobs and occupations had not worked out, and they believed that these failures were God telling them they should attend seminary and go into the ministry. Tragically, for many, the ministry didn't work out either." Unquote. One of the troubling things we discussed in episode 3 was Michael's domestic violence. Here, Yarborough asks Michael more about that.
You know, you say you've lost your temper with your wife. The way you said that indicates to me that this happened more than once.
It happened more than once.
What do you do when you get angry with her?
Usually, we shout at each other.
There have been a couple of times where I've shook her once. One time I kind of grabbed her hair at one point. I've never struck her, but it's been things like that. That's happened about 3 or 4 times.
Grabbed your hair and did what?
Just kind of grabbed her hair, you know. Not really much of anything. I shook her one time, things like that.
How does she react to this kind of behavior?
Well, a lot of it, she... Usually we make up rather quickly after that. I think she understands that a lot of it is a situation where she's still not to blame for it. She'll kind of get on me about something. She'll just kind of, oh, there's a lot of things going on. And she just kind of pushes her neck on something, which is, especially after I've done a lot, gone out of my way to do a lot of things for her or something like that. And I think she understands that there's some blame on her side as well. So I don't think it's not something that's lasting, probably, or something like that.
According to Michael, his physical violence towards his wife was at least partially her fault for nagging him or getting on to him about certain things, especially after he says he's gone out of his way to do things for her. Yarborough then moves on to the memos sent back and forth between Michael and Elizabeth. As a reminder, Elizabeth had requested certain cleaning supplies from Michael, but when he didn't get them for her, she sent a memo to Tom, who was Michael's boss. That's why Michael claims he was in the chapel on the morning of the murder, to talk to Elizabeth face-to-face and straighten out the disagreement. Here, we need to talk more about the specifics regarding those memos. In episode 3, we read some of Michael's response to Elizabeth, dated March 19th, where he outlined several reasons why her request wasn't as urgent as she was making it out to be. What we haven't talked about yet is Elizabeth's response back to Michael. Rather than writing a new memo, she took Michael's March 19th memo and sent it back with a bunch of handwritten annotations and corrections, very much in the style we'd expect from Elizabeth, given what you've heard about her in this series. At the end, after Michael requests she use the proper channels in procuring supplies, she writes this, quote, "No, I will continue to approach Tom if I'm having no response. That's what his instructions were. But please, please, Mike, do not ever write this sort of tone of memo again. You're a fellow student of mine, and I don't like you to feel like you've been put down, least of all by me. So don't take it all so personally. I repeat, all I wanted was supplies." Unquote. In the Cold Justice episode about this case, they made a big deal out of this particular memo and how it would have really irritated Michael. The implication being that this would have been one of his big motivations for wanting to kill her. During his first interview on March 26, the police ask Michael more generically about the memos, but they don't get into line-by-line specifics. But during the polygraph interview, Sam Yarborough asked Michael about this specific memo, and Michael's response is surprising.
Her memo was just
was just a little scrap of paper came to me later in the week. What did it say? Let me see that. I thought that's what you're talking about. What's out there?
She handwrote in a lot of things on yours. She's right.
No, that isn't what. Let's see what's at the bottom. I haven't seen this at all.
What did the note say that she sent to you?
Oh, no. See, I haven't seen that at all. I don't know where that was. Note that she said to me said, don't take things so seriously. Don't get so worked up about it or something like that. If that likes to get together and talk about it, it was that kind of thing.
Let's get together and talk about it.
Yeah. Just call me. No, she said, call me sometime. Also, just call or something. Call me sometime.
So, according to Michael, this was the first time he had ever seen Elizabeth's response with the handwritten annotations, which pushed back on his management and communication style. Her response wasn't dated, so we don't know for sure when she wrote it. But it's possible that it was close enough to March 26th that Michael wouldn't have seen it in time. That is, if Michael's telling the truth. Yarborough then presses Michael on his faith and any guilt he might feel.
Do you think that whoever did this to Elizabeth should be punished by a higher authority than me?
Well, I believe there's forgiveness or something like this from God. I would think that God would punish him, if it wasn't something that they confessed to God or anything like that, that should be punished. I think God does, but put that way, that sort of thing. Is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, are you saying that I think God punishes the evil?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, if you did this to Elizabeth, and it was because of the situation, and you did it out of, totally and completely out of character of yourself, would it be safe to say that at this point, you, subsequent to that kind of an act, you would truly be sorry for having done it?
Yes.
And do you think that if you were expressed truly this sorrow, that you'd be forgiven?
Yes.
And you think someone else would be? It were me that did it.
Oh, I would think so.
And I were truly sorry for it.
Well, it'd be the faith in that way. It wouldn't just be remorse. It'd be the idea that Christ would pay for his faith and what Christ has done.
Wait, but, I mean, do I have the same opportunity to be forgiven as you?
I would think so.
Do you think that if the person is truly sorry, and I mean it, see, they're truly sorry for what they did, and they, in their own heart, believe that because of their true sorrow for their act, that they have been forgiven by God, do you still think that they owe society for what they did?
Yes, I think so. I think God has put the authority here. Scripture's really clear about that. That God has set the authority here. I think they should come saying that in that aspect as well.
Do you think that their true regret and sorrow for what they did should have any impact or bearing on the civil approach to it? I mean, if God's willing to forgive, what I'm saying to you is, from what you have just said, again, you seem to be in contradiction to your religious feeling. You're saying that a man does something wrong and God can forgive them, but his fellow man can't.
Well,
or shouldn't, or won't.
I'm not saying that it can't be forgiven, but I think there is the aspect of justice that's there as well, the restitution.
Where's the justice in the Lord then? Where's his justice?
His justice would be in putting it on Christ and Christ being important. And still on the civil level, you know, for instance, if I were to have stolen something, I may be sorrowful for it, but the expression of that sorrow for it as well, it would be making restitution for it as well. Well, I think Scripture's really clear about that.
But don't you think it's rather easy to make restitution for a piece of property or amount of money as opposed to taking someone's life or taking their dignity or whatever it may be?
Yes.
I mean, how do you replace that?
I don't know.
And in some sense, the civil law is satisfied when you make restitution.
Because I'm still not certain. I guess I've answered the best I can. I think I'm not certain.
No, that's fine. I mean, there is no proper answer. Certainly, I don't have a proper answer.
I really don't know. You know, I guess there is a... I'm not certain.
God does punish people, Michael says. Back in episode 3, you heard some of our interview with Dave Thompson, who specializes in investigative interview training. Here, Dave talks more about old-school police interview techniques that would have focused on Michael's religious background during his interrogations.
This intersection of religion in the investigation, the detectives use that often during the clips that I watched, is talking about like forgiveness and what should be the consequence to somebody, and that all kind of falls in line with some of these traditional style techniques of what theme should I use here. This person's religious, so I'm going to take the religious angle of forgiveness. Or I think Michael was asked about consequences that should happen to somebody, and that's a classic question of an interview method known as the behavioral analysis interview, or BAI. But that question, you know, investigators are looking for, do they suggest severe consequence or not? And kind of the traditional way to teach that is, right, if you ask what should happen to somebody, you prefer the person says they should be, you know, convicted, thrown in jail for life or whatever. And the guilty person, and I say this in air quotes on audio recording, but the guilty person would say something like, well, it depends why they did it. Maybe they should be forgiven. And the problem with questions like that, are answers where you're trying to kind of categorize, so especially when you have people who may be very faith-based and spiritual, and you ask questions like that, it could be a terrible crime, and maybe their spirituality says, well, forgiveness, right? Depends what the reason was. And so that's another reason why things can be misclassified.
Or hell.
Or, right,
which could be problematic in the other way.
Yeah, exactly, right? So we might answer it one way, somebody else answers a different way, and that's what makes it so hard to use something like that to judge truth or innocence or guilt.
At this point, Michael's interview transitions into the actual polygraph test. Yarborough explains the mechanics of the test to Michael and does a sort of practice test, where he goes through the questions he'll be asking and has Michael answer them. Polygraph tests are often broken up like this. The pretest phase is designed to make a person afraid of being deceptive. Then the actual test repeats the same questions, and the examiner watches for signs of deception. A lot of experts question whether any polygraph test is good at figuring that out, though, and the results of the test are usually not admissible in court. Here, I want to say up front that according to letters we've reviewed, Michael's polygraph results were inconclusive. So we're playing this recording not because it contains any gotcha quotes or any new evidence, or because the examiner thought that Michael was lying about something, but because it offers a chance to hear Michael answer some questions in his own words. What's interesting is that while this practice test was recorded, the actual test was not. But then at some point after the actual test, the recording picks up again and continues for another 45 minutes. Here's the audio from the practice test.
So I'm going to go down these questions with you as they're going to be asked and in the sequence that they're going to be asked. Listen to each one carefully and then answer appropriately. Okay. First question is, today is Friday, April 20th, 1990.
Yes.
Regarding Elizabeth McIntosh's death, do you intend to answer all of my questions truthfully?
Yes.
Do you think I will ask you any unreviewed questions during this test?
No.
Before this year, have you ever committed any act of violence because of a loss of temper?
Yes.
What would that be?
That'd be thing of high school, I guess.
No, you said you didn't injure this person.
Well, I guess it depends how you define violence. And you're talking about injuring, well, injury.
Violence bringing harm, injury, destruction.
No.
No.
Not that I can remember.
One quick note. In the pre-interview, Michael described a couple fights he had during high school, which is the violence he's referencing there. Apparently, whatever physical altercations he had with his wife didn't qualify in his mind.
Question 5, did you kill Elizabeth McIntosh?
No.
Question 6, since being at Covenant, have you ever seriously wished dire harm would come to anyone? Enough that is a being with your Christian attitude. Question 7. Are you in any way responsible for Elizabeth's death?
No.
Question 8. Have you answered all of my questions truthfully during this test?
Yes.
After they finished with the practice test, they took a short restroom break before the actual test. When the recording picks up again, Yarbrough's pressing Michael on how he's responded to being accused of the murder. Essentially, he's trying to make the same point that you heard George Hodak make earlier in the series. An innocent person will eventually get angry if they keep getting accused of a crime they didn't commit. Then Yarbrough becomes more openly adversarial, accusing Michael of not cooperating.
But then answer another question for me. Why during the course of this test didn't you cooperate like I asked you to?
Cooperate in what way?
Well, I mentioned your breathing, and instead of remaining the same or improving, it got worse.
I don't know what to do about it. I'm just breathing, that's all. I don't know what to do about it. I guess maybe if I usually sit like this, maybe I just sit like this. For the second time, I was consciously trying to get my breathing regular. But outside of that, I'm not conscious of doing it.
But I'm going to tell you something. When I see someone doing things consistently during the course of recordings that I see coming from you, now this is purely opinion on my part because I can't read your mind or anyone else's. But in my opinion, that is almost tantamount to deception in and of itself because you're not letting the process take place as it should.
This goes on for quite a while. But essentially, Yarbrough accuses Michael of breathing in such a way that he's able to control his pulse and blood pressure for the purpose of trying to beat the polygraph. Michael says that he's not consciously trying to do anything like that, but he's simply trying to breathe in such a way so that he can relax. Then, in the middle of this discussion, Yarbrough changes the subject again, which seems to be a deliberate tactic to throw Michael off and get him flustered. Here's Dave Thompson again, talking about police tactics to throw off suspects and whether or not that's effective.
Depends how you define the word effective, right? I think what we've seen, I've done a lot of work on the wrongful conviction side of things where we see methods used the wrong way. Anybody, I've sat through depositions myself before. When somebody's asking you rapid fire questions and you give quick answers, you feel like you have to give quick answers. It's easy to give the wrong answer, to get kind of fumbled in your head, to be nervous. So our best practice we would teach, I think we literally have a bullet point in our workbook, avoid rapid fire questions or avoid quick questions. If you think about just the premises I was talking about it, clearly that would be a way to not let somebody give a full answer and to maybe get them down a path that you're headed towards. So I can understand an investigator often gets into this mindset wrongfully, but they have emotion too. And if they feel like they've got somebody, right or wrong, this is human nature, that emotion kind of takes over and they feel like they're getting somewhere. And I'm sure neither of you have ever been in a fight with somebody in your life verbally, but just imagine you're arguing with like a loved one, a spouse or whoever, and they say something. Sometimes you start to go back and forth so quick, you say something that you immediately regret and it's passive aggressive. And so our best practice would be, again, slow down, allow somebody to answer the question, listen to those answers so you can better follow up. The reason I said, is it effective? It depends how you define effective. You could get information that way, and it could be truthful, but I would question the reliability of information when you get it by asking questions like that.
So at this point of the recording, Yarbrough starts asking Michael about why he thinks the police consider him the prime suspect, and about the kind of person who might have killed Elizabeth.
So motive, opportunity, and there are other factors I'm sure involved too. I'm sure that this person that did this is not a cold-blooded murderer. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that there are other things going on in their life at the time that were factors also, other pressures. People don't do things like this without a lot of different pressures being exerted on them.
Well, I didn't kill her, so I know that I had pressures on me and everything else, but I didn't kill her, and I didn't see her in the morning. You know, I don't know what I'm doing wrong with this. I'm not, I think I'm just trying to relax too much. I'm trying to be typified, I don't know, but I didn't kill her. I'll try to relax more when you try it again if you want to. But I didn't even see her that morning.
You can hear Michael starting to get frustrated and also begin to offer firm declarations of his innocence, which he hadn't really done up to that point in the recordings that we've reviewed. At least not as strongly as what you just heard. Here's our interview with Dave Thompson again, which addresses this issue of how suspects might be reacting during an interrogation or a polygraph test.
There's a great clip by John Oliver. I don't know if you've seen this, but about a few months ago, he did a piece on false confessions. And he basically talks about how a lot of old training said, you know, if you avoid eye contact, that's a sign of guilt. But then he immediately reads, but if you make too much eye contact, that's a sign of guilt. And then John Oliver says, so basically, if you have eyes, you're is what he says. And so, I mean, that's the concept, but I can't blame the officers for that, having that, because that 100% is how they were trained. There was research out there about behavior and what does it mean or not mean. But today we've just got so many more reasons that people like TJ, how you might respond may be different than Ruth, may be different than me, especially based off each of our backgrounds. You know, you've got issues in today's space too, where a lot of people don't trust police, and maybe rightfully so based off their experience. And so how do you think they might act being interviewed? And that's where these behavioral things cause a concern, is somebody who's had negative interaction with law enforcement might be overly defensive or not give any information, and has nothing to do with the current incident in question, but kind of their predisposed opinion or bias. So it's difficult, and honestly, it makes it difficult for investigators too, because they're trying to figure out what the hell happened here. You know, this person stopped looking at me, they started to cross their arms, they itched their face, but that could frankly mean nothing.
Eventually, Michael suggests they take the test again, but this time he'll try not to do anything consciously with his breathing. So they do. And once again, the tape cuts off just before they start, then picks back up again sometime after the test is over.
You know, given all the circumstances as there know, that I realize there's some variables involved, you know what made me feel a lot better about you?
What?
If you had have seen her that morning.
I know. I didn't see her, though.
I'm just saying, if you had, because that was your intent, or at least part of your intent, maybe it wasn't a pleasant thing you were looking forward to, but yeah. At least...
So, let's put it this way. I looked for it in all the places where I thought she might be. I didn't go into the men's room because I didn't see the door open. I'm going on the assumption that she was dead when I was there. I saw the door closed. I'd assume she probably wouldn't have been in there.
Again, in the Cold Justice episode, they make a big deal out of the fact that Michael looked everywhere in the chapel for Elizabeth except in the men's bathroom. That's always seemed like a stretch to me, and Michael just explained why. Elizabeth would always prop the men's bathroom door open when she was cleaning in there. So it would have been reasonable for Michael to assume she wasn't in the men's bathroom if the door was closed. After the exchange you just heard, Yarborough asks Michael to sit tight, and he leaves the room for about 5 minutes. That doesn't seem like a long time, but in the context of that interview and listening to the full audio, that 5 minutes feels a lot longer. And it probably did to Michael, too, which I'm assuming is another police technique. When Yarborough returns, he said that he was talking with the Creve Coeur detectives, and that he feels like Michael is deliberately trying to manipulate the polygraph test. At this point, you can hear Michael getting even more frustrated. Then this exchange happens. And here, I'm going to let the tape play out for a few minutes, because this is the strongest recorded pushback that Michael gives, at least that we have access to.
I don't really care about this polygraph test. I mean, that's secondary here. What I do care about is, and this may sound kind of, I don't know, strange or phony, maybe even to you, but yeah, I feel about letting Elizabeth's soul rest in peace. I honestly don't believe that can be done until everything's resolved. That's the primary thing involved in all this.
I didn't do it. I just didn't. I don't understand why this won't work on me. I don't understand it. Unless I'm just tense, unless I'm trying to just control myself, I'm not consciously. I'm trying to relax. I'm trying to control. I'm trying to control myself so I don't feel all flustered and stuff like that.
That can't be. I mean, you're being accused by the police of committing a pretty serious crime. I don't know how you cannot be flustered and upset, innocent or guilty.
Uh-huh.
I don't think your innocence or guilt has anything to do with
the extent why this isn't working. I don't
know. Well, is a question that I cannot answer, because I'm doing what I can to get the recordings. I want the recordings to be proper.
I'd like to try it a couple more times and see what happens, because I didn't do it.
I don't feel good about me taking this test.
Okay.
Seriously.
I wanted it clear. I didn't do it. I just wanted it clear. I came down here, everything else to do it.
I honestly didn't murder Elizabeth McIntosh. Honest to goodness, I didn't do it. I just feel like I'm stuck now. There's no way I can resolve it. As far as with the police, I can't confess to, I don't know exactly how she was killed. I don't want to confess to them because I didn't do it. What am I supposed to do? Well, that I can't tell you, Mike. I didn't do it. Now, I wish there was some way to infallibly or whatever determine it, but I just didn't do it.
I do too. I sincerely wish there was some way to do that. I also wish there was a way to find out beyond any doubt he did.
So do I. Well, yes, I was angry with the police. Now, I can understand why the police knew what to do. And I can understand why they have to investigate the way that they did. I thought they would have shot somebody. And I thought somebody must have seen something. Something must have popped up there. You know, they took hair samples. I thought something like that would have come up. No, there was... I don't understand why something didn't come up. I can understand why they investigated me. That's why, I mean, I've been frustrated with it at times. But I can understand it. Because they don't, they're not admission either. But I didn't do it, and I just don't know what to do about it. I know, I'm a weird individual. I walked through there, and I really didn't... I walked through because I thought, well, I'd like to get this over, and confront Elizabeth and kind of talk it over with her and see... I didn't see the other note that you had. She didn't send it back to me. So, I didn't know... I thought she was fairly kind of pulled down, but I had my head set off by her before. I didn't want... On the other hand, I kind of halfway didn't want to find her. But I did look where I thought... I heard things, and I saw lights on and stuff like that. You know, what would it have been if I'd walked in? What would have happened if I'd walked in the bathroom and found her dead? Would that have absolved me? I mean, you know, what am I supposed to do? I didn't do anything. It's just this continual clouding over my head. So I thought, well, they want me to take the polygraph test. I'll take the polygraph test. You know, might as well. I know they're
in. Is there any possibility something else happened that they but you're afraid to say because of your relationship with her, that you're afraid that people are going to add two and two and end up with five?
Oh, I see her. Yes, I did see her, and I don't want to tell anybody about it.
Yeah.
No, I didn't see her either. See, that's the thing. I almost wish I had. It's happened just the way I related it. And that's what's frustrating about it. I just can't. I wish somebody had been there with me and not there or something. I just don't understand why they... I'm sorry. I just feel like such a loser. I don't know what my problem is.
Three weeks later, Michael resigned his position as housekeeping supervisor at Covenant and informed President Koistra that his family would be vacating their residence on campus as soon as a moving van was available. Shortly after, they moved to California.
What followed was weeks, then months, then years of bitter dispute between Michael and Covenant Theological Seminary. We'll talk about what went wrong, who was involved, and how it hasn't been resolved even to this day. Next time. True Believer is written, recorded, edited, mixed, and executive produced by TJ Ingracia. Co-written and co-produced by Ruth Servin-Smith. Research and development by Kyle Hackman and Doug Servin. Visit TrueBelieverPodcast.com to see additional materials related to each episode or to get in touch with us. If you're someone who knew Elizabeth or have any information related to her or her murder, we'd love to hear from you. Next time on True Believer.
Do you think it was good advice for him not to sit for Covenant's internal investigation, given that his lawyer advised him not to sit for the polygraph interview?
If it weren't a murder charge, you really want to sort of play that carefully, because the police can't do anything to you if you don't talk that they weren't going to do anyway. But your employer can. Your school can. But things you say to your employer or your school are not privileged. And anything you say there, the police can ask the school, what did he say? And they'd be required to say so. They'd be required to share that. It's not privileged. So the advice, don't talk to the police, implies, yeah, don't talk to anybody else either. Because anything you say to them, the police can learn about. And given that this is a murder charge, you really, really, really don't want that to happen.